morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society and to the beginning of our new year, I think in terms of semester. So this, I think many of you do. Part of that comes from living in a university town, I think. But here we are at the beginning of our church or fellowship year. My name is Sandy Ingham. I am Prairie's part-time consulting minister. Sometimes, obviously, I do the service. Sometimes services are done by people outside of this community and sometimes by lay people within the community. If this is one of your first times here, we urge you, of course, to come back because we want you here, but also because our services are so different that you might want to experience more than one Sunday morning. Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society prides itself on being an open-minded and an open-hearted congregation, or at least aiming for that. You are welcome here, no matter your sexual orientation, your gender, your ethnicity, your abilities, disabilities, color of your hair, I always say, color of your eyes, no matter where you are on this journey of life, you are welcome here. These are the opening words. They are words written by Unitarian Universalist minister Kathleen McTeague, titled, "This Place is Sanctuary." You who are brokenhearted, who woke today with the winds of despair whistling through your mind, come in. You who are brave but wounded, limping through life and hurting with every step, come in. You who are fearful, who live with shadows hovering over your shoulders, come in. This place is sanctuary, and it is for you. You who are filled with happiness, whose abundance overflows, come in. You who walk through your world with lightness and grace, who awoke this morning with strength and hope, you who have everything to give, come in. This place is your calling, a riverbank to channel the sweet waters of your life, the place where you are called by the world's need. Here we offer in love. Here we receive in gratitude. Here we make a circle from the great gifts of breath, attention, and purpose. Come in. Holly, would you please light the chalice, since it's not only opening day, it's our reopening day. We light this flame to remind us that, in the words of David Pohl, we come to this time and this place to rediscover the wondrous gift of free religious community, to renew our faith in the holiness, goodness, and beauty of life, and to reaffirm the way of the open mind and the full heart, to rekindle the flame of memory and hope, and to reclaim the vision of an earth made fair, with all her people one. The Duck of Enlightenment by Kathleen McTeague. She writes, "One spring afternoon, I went home a little early so I could claim an hour of study time before my children got home. As I opened the door, I was greeted by both cats, which was a little odd because they don't usually condescend to notice our coming and going unless it's dinner time. One of them promptly bolted out the open door while the other wrapped himself persistently around my legs. As I stood puzzling over this behavior, at the edge of my vision, I caught a sudden motion in the family room where there should be no motion at all in the empty house. With the hair rising on the back of my neck, I slowly moved into the house and rounded the corner of the room, and then I saw it. There was a duck in the family room, a wild brown duck, a live duck in the family room. My brain actually stopped completely for a couple of heartbeats. What should the brain do, after all, with so utterly unexpected a sight? I stood there in the doorway and said out loud, "There is a duck in the family room," as though it would help me believe it. None of the windows were open. The doors were properly closed. The duck huddled in the far corner of the room next to a clutter of books and DVDs, radiating the hope that if she kept perfectly still, I wouldn't see her. Carefully, I caught her up, a small wood duck, female, her heart tapping frantically against my hands, and carried her outside. I looked at her, full of wonder for this little visitation. Then I opened my hands. She leapt into the air in a great arc of liberation and beat her wings in a straight line of escape all the way to the horizon. I went back inside to investigate this breach of household security, and within a few minutes, the mystery was explained. A trail of ashes spilled from the fireplace, and here and there on the wall and against the ceiling, I saw soot in little feather-shaped impressions where the duck had thrown herself up toward the light. It all made sense then, how a duck could come to be standing in the middle of my house. But I felt lucky that for the space of a few breaths, my linear deductive mind had been shocked into silence. When something tumbles us into that state of wonder, the unexpected quiet in our heads is like a window flung open to the world. Instead of the routine, predictable story we live each day, there is something new under the sun, and surprised out of our minds for a moment, we actually see. Startled awake, we receive what's in front of us. Simple, astonishing, unedited. Afterward, basking in the dazzlement of my visitor, it occurred to me that it really shouldn't require a duck in the family room to awaken my wonder. Isn't the same lovely little wood duck just as wondrous, just as worthy of my awe and my open and grateful heart when she is out in the woods where she belongs? The real miracle is not that her frightened heart beat against my hands for a moment, but that her heart beats at all. That her heart beats, that my hands can hold, that my eyes can see. Well, I was only 10 miles from my destination in northern Minnesota, and I'm sorry that some of you have already heard this story. You're just going to have to hear it again. That Thursday evening in mid-July, not quite 2 months ago, just about home free, I thought. I was at the end of a 500-mile, 8-hour journey. I had had some concerns in the days before leaving Madison about whether or not my 1997 Honda would have any mechanical problems, the bane of driving old cars. Ha! Huh. I should have been so lucky. 16 miles after the odometer registered 194,000 miles, something caught my attention. So here I am, right here. I saw something out of the corner of my eye, as close as that. And I glanced over to the front passenger side of the car. Just that far away from me was a very large deer. We made eye contact, and I swear that big buck knew he had just made the biggest mistake of his life. Then, thud, I mean a really loud thud, the windshield exploded, actually imploded, into more pieces than you would ever think possible. And among other things, the inside rearview mirror snapped off. Somehow, I slowed without much swerving. I know that you're not supposed to swerve, but the gut instinct is to swerve. I brought the car to a stop on the shoulder where there was plenty of room, but no ditch, thankfully. I immediately turned the hazard lights on, and then I started to get out of the car. I'm pretty sure that I then said out loud, "Turn off the car, Sandy." So I did. And then I just stood there. I just stood there by the side of the car, never thinking of anything like a cell phone, vaguely aware of that huge deer. By the way, it was probably the largest deer ever hit on a Minnesota highway, as my son-in-law said, it sure wasn't a moose. But anyway, vaguely aware of that huge deer lying dead behind me, across the center of the highway, the center line, so that no matter which direction the car was coming or going, it had to swerve around that huge creature. Luckily, there's not a whole lot of traffic up there. To say that I was stunned would be a great understatement. Eventually, I started giving a little wave to passing cars as if I were part of a parade or something. And then a car stopped. My rescuers, Holly and Kim. Holly, you're thinking our DRE, but that's my daughter's name too. Holly and Kim, mother and daughter, who knew just what to do. They knew who to call. They knew I needed to get to this place 10 miles away. And they took everything out of my car without asking and put it in their car. And they drove me to the restaurant that my daughter and son-in-law have. I just stood there. My car was totaled, yet I walked away. Several people who saw the car remarked that I was, quote, lucky to be alive, unquote. This fact has still not fully hit me in its enormity. What do you do with that fact? Lucky to be alive. Should I throw myself into good works? Or should I party hardy? Maybe both. Now, I realize that I'm not the only person whose vehicle has been hit by a deer, quite far from it, though that was a first for me. And it shouldn't take a traumatic event to remind us that we are lucky to be alive. One of you said that in Joys and Concerns, something just about like that. As Kathleen McTeague put it in the reading, it occurred to me that it really shouldn't require a duck in the family room to awaken my wonder. Why are we here? Surely one reason must be to witness miracles, not supernatural miracles, but miracles that are right here in front of us, in each of your beautiful faces, miracles that are here if we would just notice, pay attention, be aware. Annie Dillard writes, "We are here to abet creation and to witness to it, to notice each other's beautiful faces and complex nature, so that creation need not play to an empty house." End of Dillard. Why are we here on this planet as human creatures? I think we are here to explore that humanity of which we are a part, to create an ever-widening, more all-encompassing vision and definition and reality of it, of what it means to be human. We are here, and some of you are going to gasp when I use a certain word, ready? We are here to be religious beings. Using the definition of religion from Forest Church, one of our own, religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die. Why are we here? Not only in the cosmic sense, we could do at least one entire Sunday morning service on that subject, but this morning when I asked the question, why are we here? I mean, why are we here at Prairie, in this room, at this moment in time? Well, for me, this moment in time refers to the beginning of the church years, I've already mentioned. And of course, our religious education program, excuse me, officially begins today. Schools are back in session. And I do, as I said previously, tend to think in terms of semesters. But why are we here doing our Sunday morning thing at a time when fewer and fewer people go to church? Why do we bother? What keeps us coming back? Every once in a while, I am puzzled by comments that I hear on things that I am told, or things that I am told second or third hand, which in that case means that I don't know how accurate they are, right? A recent one was from an anonymous survey conducted by our Religious Education Committee. One respondent said that they came to Prairie for, quote, community and values, but not for Unitarian, Universalist theology. Are those not the same thing? Why are we here? Well, we're here to keep alive the history of this movement. People gave their lives for us. Do you know that? And I don't mean people broadly. I mean people from our tradition gave their lives for us. People in Poland, Hungary, Romania, for example, in the 1500s died, executed by the state, or thrown out of their homes. These were wealthy people because they had big homes, to wander around Europe until they died from the elements. They died so that we could be free thinkers. This is why we make, if we're lucky, pilgrimages to Transylvania, which you know I got to do a couple years ago. This is the part of the world where it all began for the Unitarian side of our heritage, especially. Why are we here? We are here to be the storytellers of our time, to tell the stories of Faustus Socinius, who was Polish, and yes, lost his life, and King Sigismund and Francis David of Transylvania, who were both killed because they stood up for religious freedom. We're here to keep alive the actions of James Reeb, if you want to talk about more current times, and Viola Liuzzo. Reeb was a Unitarian Universalist minister. Liuzzo was a layperson. They both were killed during the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Why are we here? We are here to continue the work of Dorothea Dix, Sophia Lyon Foss, Emerson, Thomas Paine, Edward Everett Hale, Louisa May Alcott, Frances Parkman, William Prescott, Julia Ward Howe, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Lucy Stone, Margaret Fuller, Horace Mann, Elizabeth Peabody, Peter Cooper, Henry Bird, George William Curtis, Henry Bellis, Joseph Priestley, Charles Darwin. I could go on and on and on and on. And I haven't even gotten out of the early 1900s yet. But if we don't know who these people are, and if we are clueless about what they did, well, obviously, we can't tell their stories or continue their work. But more to the point, shame on us if we are Unitarian Universalist history illiterates. We learn looking backward, we live looking forward. That's an anonymous quote that I ran across. It neatly sums up my experience being an activist for social justice. It also fits in with that Mendelssohn quote from the top of your order of service. You might want to look at it. The Unitarian Universalist religion's gift to me has been the opportunity to unfold. The special joy of breaking out of the cocoon, of finding a greater freedom in the exercise of my intelligence and in the growth of my experience of love, beauty, and justice. That has been exactly my experience also of what this faith tradition has given to me. Knowing about the martyrs in our past helps me, it energizes me, it challenges me to keep on keeping on, and that's not easy in the times we live in. These are terrifying times. Every time I attend General Assembly, I come back with some cutting edge ideas about why, about more unfolding, not just my own, but also that of Unitarian Universalism. Why are we here? I believe that we are here to love life, to be joyful, to be grateful, to do all that we can do. As my parents and my Presbyterian ancestors put it, We are here to leave the world a better place than we found it. We are here to try to understand what it means to be human and then to work on becoming as fully human as possible. Barbara Rohde, who is a Unitarian Universalist lay leader in one of our congregation, says, "When our oldest child was 5 years old, she walked into the kitchen one morning and announced, 'I haven't made my decision yet about heaven.' I was somewhat startled," Rohde writes. "Heaven wasn't a very big topic of conversation in our house, and one wouldn't expect a small person carrying Raggedy Ann by one arm to be thinking much about it. But I said, 'What do you mean you haven't made your decision?' She said, I don't know whether you go there when you die or whether you just lie down dead forever.'" She paused for a moment and added, "And that's why I think it is sometimes hard to be a person." What is remarkable about that conversation, Rohde said, is not so much that a five-year-old was wrestling with questions of immortality, not that, you know, she already had a sense that things, personhood was an issue at age five. Will I become a person? Will I become the person I'm intended to become? But the task of becoming a person, Rohde says, is what life is all about. The care that helps others become their true selves is what parenthood is about, what the ministry is about, lay and professional ministry. I suppose, Rohde concludes, what led most of us to Unitarian Universalism is our understanding that the central question of religion is not whether one lives forever, but whether one lives. We're here to covenant with one another, I believe. That's a subject that I'll explore in a future Sunday. I think you probably know the word covenant, which I guess we could, one interpretation would be what we promise each other. I believe we are here to covenant with each other here in this room. Jack Mendelsohn said that when he was growing up, he wanted to be challenged and shaken. "I wanted my spirit to be given something to strive for. I wanted to know why the world could be at once such a wondrous and ugly place. I wanted to know why there was both laughter and hurt in me. If God created me, I wanted to know who created God." Mendelsohn grew up in a traditional Protestant church. And he's referring in those quotes to his adolescent self. Aren't those ages wonderful, from 10, 11, 12 through the teens? Those are great years for questioning. When Jack Mendelsohn was 8, his mother died suddenly. He writes, "In the sense that I was determined to ask why, and how do you know, I suppose that my religious future was set the night my mother died." Mendelsohn went on, he's died fairly recently, to be minister of the Arlington Street, our congregation in Boston. He was also minister of the biggest church in Indianapolis. He was vice president of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. He was noted within Unitarian Universalism for his social justice work. Now, I suffered no such tragedy in my childhood. I was very fortunate as a child in so many ways, but I can relate to what Mendelsohn says about wanting to be challenged and shaken. How can the world be both wondrous and ugly? How can I have both laughter and tears and hurt in me in this kind of a world? These questions and complexities, of course, led me to a love of life. Without knowing it, I was searching for Unitarian Universalism for the first 30 years of my life. Without realizing it, I was looking for, to quote Mendelsohn again, a spiritual life that offers not surrender and salvation. Now, that was supposed to be the basis of my spiritual life, of course, growing up Presbyterian. A spiritual life that offers not surrender and salvation, but love of life in spite of life. I love that quote. Love of life in spite of life. It's not an easy road, is it, to love life in spite of life? Mary, you're sorrow and concern. It's so hard. Like Charlie in the story for all ages, I want to be ready for life. So just in case, I do A, B, and C. So things will be okay, right? And turn out okay. And then maybe I do X, Y, and Z. And then there's a big thud. Or sometimes it's a small one. Or, as in Charlie's case, it seems that the whole wide world has forgotten my birthday and I'm not the slightest bit ready for that thud or that curveball that life throws to us. But that's okay. If we have something to fall back on, if we have resources, if we can count on something other than ourselves. And that is what membership in a congregation gives us. Sometimes we question why we're here at Prairie, why we keep coming back, being kind to everyone, and trying to seriously listen to each other, and stepping out of our comfort zones to try out new ways of thinking, and occasionally having to be called names by your minister, like white supremacists. That can all be pretty irritating. Sometimes trying to work through our differences or attempting to reach a consensus on bylaws, don't forget to come to the parish meeting 2 weeks from today, to reach a consensus on bylaws or policies and procedures, this can seem like such a painfully slow process. It's that creak, creak, creak in the night that Charlie prepared for. If you're not sitting up here, you probably didn't hear that. Thud, it was a thud. Why do we bother? A group of Unitarian Universalists came to a fork in the road. On one road sign are the words to heaven. On the other, to a discussion about heaven. Without hesitation, they choose their path. Yes, of course, they choose the path to discussion because they would never pass up a chance to have a discussion. So we make slow progress here. And one of our seven principles is all about that democratic process. Why are we here? Why is it important to sign the membership book and be an official member of a Unitarian Universalist congregation? Why promote yourself up to member rather than stay as a friend? What do you get by signing the book? Well, this is another one of those comments that I hear too often. I don't get anything by signing the book. We joke about the fact that we're going to ask for a pledge, but we ask for a pledge from you, whether you're a friend or a member. You don't have to sign a book to pay money. We really joke about, well, now that you've signed the membership book, you can be on the board or be the president of the chair of a committee. And of course, you have to sign the membership book to vote, which is very important. We are going up to, what do you gain by signing the book? Nothing. Nothing. Don't fall over, Aaron. I'm not done. Aaron Bosch is co-chair of the membership committee. What do you gain by signing the book? Nothing except the companionship of other free thinkers who want to be on the side of love, those who would agree with Martin Buber when he said to Jack Mendelsohn, throughout the world, there is a spiritual front on which is being waged a secret, silent struggle between the desire to be on life's side and the desire to destroy. This is the most important front of all. Do you know when Martin Buber said those words? In the 1950s. They're so, so, so relevant today. What do you get to experience as a member of this congregation? Well, storytelling, of which the world needs more. You get adventure, exploring, challenges, blooming. Look at that quote again at the top of your order of service. You get flowering, sanctuary. Remember the opening words. You get sanctuary. You get all this is yours. Getting ready for the demands and the challenges and the curveballs that the world will throw at you, none of which you would have imagined getting ready for life, just in case. That's why you sign the membership book. When I first knew about Unitarian Universalism, I had trouble putting it into words when, you know, people always say, well, what is that? Is that a religion? Is that place that doesn't believe anything or believes everything? Or as my mother's hairdresser said to me when my mother, of course, had to blurt out what I was doing, this is in my seminary days, oh, you're vegetarians, right? Or, no, isn't that the place that Madonna goes? Okay, so one way I used to define it, Unitarian Universalism, was for me personally, it was like this. Now I'm nowhere near over here in my open-mindedness and my open-hearted. Another way is this. What will you get? The joy, the challenge of being part of a covenant, those promises that we humans make to each other to bring laughter and humor and love into our lives intentionally, so we can have some assurances that we won't lose track of these parts of our humanity. What do you get by signing the book? Nothing. Nothing really tangible or concrete, but you get a greater commitment to a place which offers space, freedom, courage, security, in the sense of a safe space, the opportunity to unfold and experience that special joy of breaking out of the cocoon, of finding a greater freedom in the exercise of your intelligence and in the growth of your experience of love, beauty, and justice. Sometimes we will have moments when we just stand there beside this faith tradition of ours, doing nothing because we are stunned by a thud or we are scared. But then with help from this community, we recover from that thud that sent us off course briefly sometimes, sometimes for longer than briefly, and we get back into the thick of it, the thick of daily living, trying again to be the kind, caring, compassionate people that we know we are capable of being, knowing that it matters what we believe and that it matters whether or not we sign the membership book. From Wayne Arneson, these are the closing words. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard, the path is never clear, and the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone. May it be so. Go in peace. Go downstairs and visit RE. Drink coffee. All those good things.